Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense. Today on the program, a topic that really is incredibly difficult to cover on radio, or on any form of media, to be honest, and that's reason enough in our books to give it a shot. This essay, Exploration, is from my RN colleague, Wendy Zukerman.
Incest, pedophilia, infanticide, cannibalism, bestiality. These are some of the greatest taboos of our time. They're so contentious that in the 21st century, we can only very carefully discuss them on radio. But why? Does it make society better by hiding away the darkest desires of some people? And will it always be this way? On today's show, we're exploring taboos, where they come from, why we have them, and we'll also be looking forward and questioning what will be taboos in the future. First, let's start with the word taboo. What does it mean?
Well, taboo is basically whatever's forbidden.
This is Kate Burridge, a professor of linguistics at Monash University and author of Forbidden Words, Taboo and the Censoring of Language.
And it came into English in the 18th century. It was actually Captain Cook that brought it into English. It comes from Tongan. So in that context, it was forbidden behaviour, behaviour that was believed to be, well, ominous or evil or somehow, you know, offensive to supernatural powers. So in that context, if you violated a taboo, it could have dire consequences. So a little different from the way we understand the term, I suppose, today. So it's more social etiquette, isn't it, that drive the taboos today.
According to Professor Burridge, many taboos are so overwhelming that we have developed a language just to talk about them. The language of euphemism.
Well, it's a beautiful example of human doublethink, isn't it? Because you can, you know, something that can't be talked about properly or directly in a certain circumstance can be talked about by using this kind of, well, euphemistic avoidance language, this kind of smokescreen. And it is a kind of bizarre thing because excrement is fine, but shit isn't. It refers to the same thing, but somehow these words, these taboo words, are so powerful. I mean, there's even evidence that they are, if not stored differently in the brain, they're certainly accessed differently.
Tell us about that.
Well, there have been these studies done by, well, psycholinguists and also neurolinguists into, I suppose, the storage of these words. Because the interesting thing is that some people lose all language ability except the ability to produce taboo words. So, for example, they can swear like a trooper, but, you know, if they're called upon to repeat the performance, they can't because they've lost the ability to produce ordinary language. So that would only be possible if these words were, well, if not stored separately, then at least accessed differently in the brain.
According to Steven Pinker, a professor of Harvard University, taboos have such a forceful place in our society because they signify not just if we're willing to engage in certain behaviour, like incest or infanticide, but they signify whether we are inherently good people or not.
If someone were to ask you, how much money would you accept to sell your child? Well, the right answer is not, how much are you offering or you can't afford it. It would be, I'm offended that you would ask. I refuse to even consider that question. Why? Because if you were to join the terms of the conversation, if you actually consider it, you're betraying the fact that you are not a decent parent, that you're not placing infinite value on the life of your child. And so the taboo is, that is, the understanding that certain topics may not be discussed, may not be considered, may not be thought about, reinforces the very nature of your commitment, in this case, your commitment to being a parent.
Why do you think that this system of making something taboo has developed?
It's because our social relationships often depend not just on what we do, but on what we are. What kind of a person are you? Do you have a price? Can you be corrupted? Or are you just conveniently cooperating with me because it's in your interests. If I have a choice between two people to hang out with, cooperate with, work with, live with, one is doing it because it's profitable for him in the short term. The other one is just put together, wired in a way that he can't help but love me and work with me, and it'd just be impossible constitutionally for him to betray me, no matter how much it might be in his interest to do so. Who am I going to hang out with? The second guy, clearly. And taboo is a way of signaling that we are the second kind of person.
Now, this isn't particularly logical. Someone who engages in consensual sex with their brother or sister, for example, won't necessarily cheat you in a business deal. Yet, this idea that engaging in particular taboos speaks to your wider personality ultimately pervades much of our thinking. Consider a woman who wants an abortion.
So when it comes to abortion, termination of pregnancy, it's quite interesting, not in a good sense, how this subject is exactly the same in every society.
This is Dr. Tana Luna, a specialist in obstetrics and gynecology for Doctors Without Borders. Dr. Luna has worked around the world in Liberia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Pakistan, Sydney, and she believes that women who want abortions are treated as taboo because in a world where men and women have defined roles, which have mostly been defined by men, for a woman not wanting to be pregnant, well, that suggests she's not a proper woman.
A woman is not suppose meant to have this desire of wanting to terminate a pregnancy, probably because it is considered for you to be fertile and have babies. So when you're going against that, that's not natural. You're extremely stigmatized as a woman when you don't want a pregnancy. And that happens exactly the same in Sydney, in Central African Republic.
The taboo on abortion also speaks to the idea that taboos aren't inherently human. They're created by certain societies. And a really potent example of that is female genital mutilation. Here's Dr. Tana Luna again.
When it comes to female genital mutilation, most countries where that is a practice, they are considered like if they are not mutilated, they will develop a disproportionate sexual desire and they will, of course, not be loyal to their husbands.
And in cultures where it is completely socially acceptable to have female genital mutilation, and in fact it is, as you mentioned, a problem if you have not had that, what then becomes taboo when it is socially acceptable to have mutilation?
I would say the taboo is the opposite, like you're not allowed to not to have it. So the whole situation around about the need of having it is a taboo. You cannot discuss it. It is a fact, and you have to go through the process. You're not allowed to challenge that.
In the next part of the program, we're going to explore what happens to a topic once it becomes taboo. In most cases, society creates these taboos because they want to stop certain behaviour. But what really happens?
My own experience with sexuality was that all of it was banned when I was a kid.
This is Chrissy Kneen, an erotic writer based in Brisbane. She's written about incest and bestiality. And growing up in the 1970s and early 80s, there was a taboo on female sexuality in her house. And that ultimately led her to become an erotic writer.
So I had no access to any discussion, talk, reading about sexuality when I was a kid because I was brought up by my grandmother and she didn't want any kind of glimpse of sexuality to enter our lives. So we were really kept as innocents. For my 13th birthday, I was really interested in science fiction and fantasy and I was given a Marion Zimmer Bradley book. And I'd read her stuff before, but this particular book, when I got it, had paragraphs cut out of it and whole pages torn out of it because there was mentions of sexuality on those pages. And I remember thinking, something is so important that it has to be removed from a book that I read. There must be some power in that. And I think that was a moment when I realized that my life's journey was to kind of look at the power of sexuality and try and work out why we consider some things taboo and some things okay.
And of course, it wasn't just in the home of Chrissy Kneen that people were being sheltered from sex talk. In 1976, the Educational Commissioner of Texas banned the four major American college dictionaries from schools because it had several words that he objected to, including bed, deflower, John, G-string, slut, and bastard. I asked Professor of Linguistics Kate Burridge what the intention was here. Did the Educational Commissioner think that people would stop going to bed if it wasn't in the dictionary?
Well, I think that's right. I think there are some people that think if you ban these words, then somehow is this very sort of Orwell, isn't it? You know, if you newspeak, if you take the words away, then we won't even be able to think of these things, which, of course, is a nonsense. And in fact, the history of taboo shows that periods of censorship and repression, whether it's full-blown sanctions or just social niceties, it only ever seems to provide a more fertile breeding ground for these words to flourish. If you look at the first ever censorships, the rules of laws against blasphemy and profanity on the stage, this was in the Renaissance period. Did people stop using these words? Well, they just became more cunning. And this is when you got a lot of this disguised language. We've got relics today like zounds or zoons, which was God's wounds, svut, God's foot, slidikins, you know, every part of God's anatomy was sworn upon, but always done in heavy disguise. And then when the Victorian era, when people became so squeamish about anything really below the waist, again, these words, there was this kind of flourishing of these words that just went underground. And in fact, the Victorian era is when you get the most fantastic dictionaries of the vulgar tongue. A lot of people went about collecting these taboo words, and they really did flourish. And the same today. There's been, I think in the 1990s, there was a publication, a dictionary of racial slurs, you know, whole new litany of dislike, I think is how the lexicographer put it. So against this kind of public niceness, so-called political correctness, there's again this sort of flourishing of dirty words, this time in the form of racial and ethnic slurs. So it doesn't have much effect, really.
Despite centuries of evidence showing that when you make something a taboo, it doesn't stop it. In Australia today, many issues are still kept in the dark of taboo. Consider pedophilia. Our almost deafening silence on even speaking about this topic was broken by the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse, which began in 2013.
The Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, says she will take steps to establish a Royal Commission looking into the sexual abuse.
That too many children have suffered child abuse, but have also seen other adults let them down.
They've not only had their thousands of expected individual claims. The federal government says it will be one of the largest royal commissions ever held in Australia.
And since then, we've been confronted almost every week with cases of pedophiles working in institutions across Australia.
Every child was a potential pedophile victim. We were groomed.
Of course, my daddy, I'd never seen my daddy, but I wanted somebody to protect me.
Former students have held back tears, recalling their abuse at the hands of teachers they thought they could trust. And
if ever there was an example that silence doesn't eke out a taboo, pedophilia is the exemplar of our time.
Yeah, I don't think it's helpful. You know, the whole, oh, don't talk about it, don't think about it, doesn't make it go away.
That's Dr. Amy Lackens, a clinical psychologist and human sexuality researcher at the University of New England in Armidale, New South Wales. According to Lackens, the silence on pedophilia has ultimately done our community a disservice. It's meant that those who feel sexual desires towards minors have no place to seek help, and that increases the risk that they'll act out on those feelings.
It puts individuals into this space where they're lonely, they can get depressed, they can get anxious, substance abuse can come along with that. And then you get people who are more likely to offend because they're not dealing with their issues, and they're putting themselves in a situation where their inhibitions can be lowered, and so it doesn't really help, I don't think.
Dr. Tana Luna agrees that a lot of pain and suffering could be avoided by breaking taboos
and just talking about issues.
Totally.
You always have the opposite effect in anything that you want to silence, and always. You need to talk about things and you need to put opinions out there. Doesn't matter if it's about pedophilia or about, I don't know, in many countries it's forbidden to have sex before 18 years old. Just put it out there. Let's talk about it. There's nothing that should be not allowed to talk about. Making a topic taboo also has an incredible impact on the way that scientists can study and therefore understand an issue. Here's Harvard Professor Steven Pinker, who we heard from earlier in the show.
There's a built-in tension between scholarship, science, analysis, honest history often, and society's taboos. Because if you're a committed scientist or an analytic scholar more generally, you want to understand how things work. There's no idea that cannot be thought. So the value that certain ideas may not be thought pushes in the opposite direction to scientific inquiry, which is why often scientists from Galileo onward have found themselves at the wrong end of societal taboos and have found themselves the target of moralistic outrage.
Consider researching pedophilic tendencies in the community.
Here's the way that the common fear would go, and I've seen this in many different versions. If, for example, there's a widespread tendency among men to be attracted to underage sexual partners, then you'd be saying men can't help it, we shouldn't go after pedophiles, they're just doing what they can't help. Now, that's clearly illogical. Any kind of desire is distributed unevenly among people, and even when people have a desire, they can certainly learn to control it, especially if there's a widespread norm against it and sanctions. So the question of why people do it and whether there's a way to make them stop are not the same question. I would say that, in fact, that unless you understand why people do something, you're not going to be very effective in getting them to stop.
So, according to Steven Pinker, we might be able to prevent harm if we unshackled ourselves from the taboo of studying pedophilia.
So that's a clear example of if you think clearly, there is an enormous amount to gain by an honest, disinterested, and non-squeamish study of the bases of pedophilia. But alongside it, you've got to be clear that the morality and the science are two different things. We can understand what makes pedophiles do their thing and still condemn it as exploitation of the child and figure out ways of minimizing it.
A small group of researchers, including Dr. Amy Likens, have begun these non-squeamish studies of people with pedophilic tendencies. And their work is beginning to suggest that pedophilia, just like all sexuality, has at least some basis in the brain.
What it's really starting to look like is that it's got prenatal origins in the sense that if you look at brain structure, if you look at brain connectivity, if you look at minor physical abnormalities, things that are sort of indicative of a little bit of development gone a little bit wrong, or it's different anyway from the average, is that you find that you have higher rates of this in people with pedophilia. So it doesn't say, okay, well, if you see this, then that person's a pedophile. Would never argue that, but what you do see are kind of these perturbations in what look like in prenatal development that sort of either crosswire the kind of sexual attraction versus caretaking urges that we have as humans, that it seems to be a bit crosswired for pedophiles, where the urges that most of us have for children is to take care of them and make sure that they're safe and nurture them. And we have sexual attraction toward adults who are more physically able to have children, that with pedophiles, it looks like it's getting cross-wired in some way that we're really only at the beginning stages to understand. But
that's quite different to the theory that seemed to be pervading for some time, that pedophiles were the victims of abuse themselves. Is this kind of a shift that you're seeing in the community that studies this?
Definitely a shift. I think that my personal opinion would be that we sort of looked for these explanations because we didn't have anything else, right? So we didn't have the kind of technology that we do with MRI, for instance, to be able to look at actual brain structure and see differences. So we look for answers of what we can understand. So you do tend to see, in some cases, higher rates of people who go on to be pedophiles as having experienced child sexual abuse. But again, it's not a one-to-one. So it's not that every person who experiences child abuse themselves goes on to be pedophilic, or that every pedophile has experienced child sexual abuse. So it's sort of looking at environmental and biological underpinnings of sexual attraction, and quite similar to what we see with other sexual attractions. So you get pedophiles, the ones who are willing to admit talking about it and say, look, I've always felt this way. I didn't grow up and start to be attracted to adults. I was attracted to 9-year-olds or 12-year-olds or whatever, and I still am. And so it's quite similar to what we see with anybody's sexual attractions is, you know, I'm attracted to this, and I've always kind of felt that I'm attracted to this, and I don't really know where it came from or why.
Despite the potential benefits that may arise from studying taboos and truly ripping them out of secrecy, Professor Steven Pinker says that sometimes society just isn't ready. He uses the example of looking at genetic differences between groups, like Jewish people or African Americans or Anglo-Saxons.
We always have to make choices as to which scientific questions are most central. There are limited resources, there's a finite number of scientists, and maybe there's certain topics where they're not central to our understanding of the human species, and race is a fairly peripheral topic in the biology of humans, that maybe we can concentrate on other things until there's an atmosphere in which those findings can be absorbed with fewer negative consequences.
In the final part of this program, we're going to look to the future. What will be the taboos of the 22nd century? Will there be less taboos than there are now? Well, to know that, we have to know how something stops being taboo.
Okay, so first of all, let me just say that the word I've used for this process is moralization.
Paul Rosen is a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania.
It's something enters the moral domain. And if something enters the moral domain, then either doing it or not doing it is very negatively regarded. So, for example, smoking entered the moral domain. Smoking was okay 50 years ago. Now people who smoke are undesirable, right? We don't put them in prison because it's not illegal, but they're not desirable. So we have other things like gay marriage, which have gone from, that's called amoralization or demoralization. You go up from the moral domain into the preference domain. If you want to be gay, that's up to you. It's not, doesn't have any moral status. So both things are happening. So things go in and out of the moral domain. As when, for example, marijuana is becoming, in the United States, demoralized now. A number of states have already allowed individuals to possess and use marijuana. 25 years ago, that would have been inconceivable. So we're in a period now in the developed world where individual preferences are given priority. It's a sort of a libertarian idea. You can do what you want as long as nobody else is hurt.
And how do things in general move from the moralizing domain to becoming accepted in a way?
Okay, well, that's, of course, a very interesting historical question. So you've experienced, as I have, the demoralization of homosexuality. And what happened? Well, it's a gradual process where I think one of the things that happens is it becomes a matter for discussion. That is to say, it's not a subject you could even talk about. 50 years ago, homosexual people nobody was sure they were, right? They were just quietly doing their thing in secret. And then, you know, more and more people revealed it, and a couple of prominent people maybe, and that maybe gave it a push. We don't exactly know how it happened, but it happened very gradually. What's interesting about gay marriage is it happened very rapidly. It went from being unacceptable in the United States to being reasonably acceptable in a short period of like 5 or 10 years. It shocked me how quickly something held so strongly and morally that marriage was sacred, and that in a lot of people's views, gay individuals are a little, you know, they're not really regular people already. And all of a sudden, we're legalizing gay marriage.
Why do you think? Because then we have other taboos that are not moving forward so quickly. Is that because there hasn't been some kind of human push? There was a gay rights movement that was obviously very strong and has proved to be somewhat successful.
I think that one of the major issues is a political issue. Can you organize and present your case and influence other people?
According to Steven Pinker, when it comes to some sexual taboos, it seems like we are becoming more liberal. Or in Paul Rosen's terms, some fetishes are moving from the moral domain to the preference domain.
A lot of the taboos that would be respected in our national newspapers, magazines, radio networks, television networks, you find breached all the time in magazines and websites for 20-somethings. I consider myself a fairly liberal, unrepressed person, but I'm often shocked at the overt discussions of sexuality, different techniques for sexual gratification and sexual problems in magazines aimed at younger people, and it makes me feel very old. The question is, as the 20-somethings get older, will they carry their more relaxed norms with them as they age? Do we change as we get older so they'll enforce the same taboos when they're in a position to do so? But it's certainly a change in our culture. Probably of the two alternatives, I suspect that the younger people will be bringing their more relaxed norms with them, and some of the taboos on sexuality will indeed be relaxed.
When looking to the future of taboo, erotic author Chrissy Kneen believes that the widespread use of social media will ultimately break taboos on the relationship between public and private.
At the moment, if we have a Prime Minister of Australia who has a dick pic or a vagina pic in their history, that becomes big news and it's scandalous. But this generation, they've all got those pictures out there. There are pictures of people having sex as teenagers. And like everyone is going to be subject to embarrassing pictures that can be unearthed in the future. So that actually won't be an issue for them. I actually think that we will just be accepting of the fact that everyone has a sexuality and everyone has a wild time that is going to be recorded and can be dragged out. You know, glass houses, who throws the first stone in the future. So I don't think that we're going to have people pretending to be more moral or less sexual as they pretend to be now.
Professor Kate Burridge has a different take on technology and taboo. She says that despite all of our fancy devices and seeming advancements,
We will never lose taboos, though. I mean, there are always certain things that we will want to screen off, I think, and talk about in a roundabout way. I think we, you know, if you think about technology, it's made a whole lot of things in our life easier, but it hasn't really helped us with the sort of, I suppose, the messy reality of life, the fact that we have our feet firmly planted in nature, that our sort of natural mortal condition still makes, you know, death and disease and bodily effluvia difficult for us, I think. The things that remind us that we are mortal.
So while we might be becoming more liberal in some respects, according to Kate Burridge, taboo as a concept is unlikely to disappear. And she offers a reason as to why this is.
Taboos act, I suppose, a little bit like glue that sticks members of a society together. So, you know what one society cherishes, another society is going to spurn. So, you know, we'll always have these for that reason, I think. Solidarity.
Some find it disappointing that taboos might persist, not to protect people, but to bind us together. But perhaps we'll find a time in the future where we will start talking about these dark corners, as uncomfortable as they may be, because we finally recognise that that's the best way to reduce harm.
And that special report from my RN colleague Wendy Zukerman. The guests were author Chrissy Kneen, Kate Burridge from Monash University, Steven Pinker from Harvard, Tana Luna from Doctors Without Borders, Amy Likens from the University of New England, and Paul Rosen from the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time on Future Tense, cheers.
On the Health Report, is it a myth that you can't drink alcohol while you're on drugs like antibiotics?
Have you ever been on medication and had a little alcohol to drink?
Yes.
Which one?
All of them. I'm doing it right now.
No, because otherwise they don't work.
I don't think that's real. That's not real.
And if you want to hear that less than sober health report with me, Norman Swan, why not download a podcast from RN's website?